It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. The World Food Prize is an annual international award that recognizes the achievements of individuals who've advanced human development by improving the quality, quantity, or availability of food in the world. My guest this half hour is Sir Fazlay Hassan Abed. He is the 2015 World Food Prize laureate, and the honor was given to him for his work as founder and chairperson of the world's largest anti-poverty organization, the Bangladesh Rural Advancement Committee. It goes by the acronym BRAC. Many have hailed it as the most effective anti-poverty organization in the world. Under Abed's leadership of more than 40 years, its agricultural and development innovations have improved security for millions. Also, it's contributed to a significant decline in poverty levels through direct impacts to farmers and small communities across the globe. The organization has provided opportunity for nearly 150 million people worldwide. Sir Fazlay Hassan Abed, welcome to our program.
Good afternoon, and thank you for a wonderful introduction.
I understand that the birth of your organization stems from a couple of cataclysmic events in Bangladesh,
homeland,
the deadly tropical cyclone, and then the War of Independence from Pakistan. Tell us how your organization was born in the midst of that.
Well, I worked for Shell Oil Company as one of their senior executives in 1970, when a cyclone occurred in the November of that year, which killed 300,000 people. And when I went to do some relief work in some of the offshore islands, which was devastated by the cyclone, I started questioning the kind of life I was leading as a comfortable business executive in the face of the fragility of life of human beings sort of taken away by a cyclone of that magnitude. And so the transformation started happening at that time. And then, of course, immediately after that, there was the struggle for independence from Pakistan, which lasted almost 9 months. But with the aid of our own independence fighters and the help of India, we became independent fairly soon. And so in early 1972, Bangladesh was independent. Bangladesh was born as an independent country. And, of course, at that time, Bangladesh was the poorest country on earth. It's the problems were tremendous, immense, and the problems were multifaceted. It was the poorest country. It had very high population, 70 million population, and the Bangladesh is the size of Iowa. So you can see that about 50 times the population of Iowa in 1972. And now, of course, we have more than doubled our population. So now we are 50 times the population of Iowa's. So population was one of the very, very high population.
Mm-hmm.
We had life expectancy at birth of 46. Our child mortality rate was 250 per 1,000, which means that one in four children died before their fifth birthday. Our maternal mortality was very high. Our fertility was out of control. Average women produced 6.4 children. So these were the situation in Bangladesh.
Let me ask you, you said the average life expectancy, 46 years. What were what contributed to that low life expectancy?
Mostly it was because of high infant and child mortality. As I said, 25% of the children died before their fifth birthday. So that, of course, reduced.
Is this starvation or disease?
No, it's disease, mostly diarrhea and pneumonia and things like that. And we didn't immunize all our children, as a result of which unimmunized children, of course, had a higher death rate. So that was one of them. And, of course, now Bangladesh is, now that we have been able to had some dramatic declines in infant and child mortality as well as maternal mortality, we have been able to bring about control in fertility rates. It used to be 6.4 children per woman. Now it's 2.1. So as a result, Bangladesh is now becoming almost, we have achieved replacement level fertility.
Mm-hmm. So how did you achieve on the fertility aspect there? How did you achieve that? Because especially poor families are not willing to often give up the ability to make children because that's the way
they sort of protect their future.
Exactly.
Yeah. What happened is that we thought that unless we can bring down infant and child mortality in a dramatic way, we will not be able to get women to accept family planning. So we took up a program in 1980. It was 1979. It was the International Year of the Child. So we decided that we should do something in Bangladesh which would have an impact on infant and child mortality. So we took up a program for 10 years to go from house to house, teach mothers how to make oral rehydration fluid at home with salt, sugar, and water, which sort of rehydrated the body of children who were suffering from diarrhea. And that had a big impact in terms of diarrheal mortality reduction. And then also in 1986, BRAC, together with the government, took up the institutionalized immunization program. It took the immunization rate from 4% in 1986 to 72% in 1990. It took us 4 years to institutionalize immunization program in the country. And that immunization and oral dehydration now being practiced throughout the country meant that the infant mortality rate started declining dramatically. In fact, last year, Lancet, a medical journal in England, they came out with a report on Bangladesh's health status and said that nowhere in the world, other than possibly the time in Japan in 1868, after the Meiji Restoration, no other country has been able to reduce infant and child mortality at the rate at which Bangladesh has been able to do.
Mm-hmm. How did Bangladeshi women then, the families, become comfortable with having fewer children then?
So less mortality means that the fewer children would survive to adulthood. And as a result, women were quite content having two children rather than six in order to ensure protection in old age. And secondly, also, the other thing has happened is that the children mostly in early days were not going to school, so there was not much of an investment on children's future. And now that most children are now going, more than 95% of our children are in school, it means that children families are having to now invest money in their education. So as a result, the number of children has reduced, and the families are now not only producing less children, but also investing more in their children's future. As a result, fertility has declined. There is a theory propounded by one of the economists in Australia who said that if the intergenerational resource flow, if the resource flows from younger to the older generation, the fertility tends to be high.
Mm.
And if the resource flows from older to the younger generation, fertility tends to be low. So if you have two children, if you have to invest money on their education, and you don't expect anything to come to you afterwards, then of course you will keep your fertility low. In other words, you'll have less children.
Mm-hmm.
So that's theory seemed to have worked very well in Bangladesh, in the sense that as soon as women started investing in the education of their children, the fertility declined. And now we have got 2.1 fertility rate, which is the replacement level fertility.
If you've just joined us, my guest this half hour is Sir Fasle Hassan Abed. He is the 2015 World Food Prize laureate, and we're talking about his work as the founder and chairperson of the world's largest anti-poverty organization. Many hail it as the most effective anti-poverty organization in the world, the Bangladesh Rural Advancement Committee, also known as BRAC. We mentioned women there. You focus on as an organization in rural areas. You concentrate on specific disadvantaged populations,
right.
Landless, women, fishermen.
Right.
Talk about women. Why is a focus on women, empowering women as agents of change?
Yes, that's what we have done. From our own experience working in villages, we saw that women actually bore the brunt of poverty. In other words, if there was lacking in food in the family, the woman who was going to go and beg, borrow, or steal from neighbors to feed their children. So the burden of poverty fell disproportionately on women. So we thought that if women could manage poverty, then why shouldn't they be able to also manage development? And that's one of the reasons why when we started microfinance, financial services for the poor, we concentrated on women as agents of change. And so the money in the hands of women also meant that they used it more effectively. They used it also for the purpose to help their families, educate children, bring food to the table, and so on, which not necessarily giving men financial services would have the same kind of result.
Mm-hmm. And did the men accept this, or was that part of the education?
Initially, they resented that, but then gradually, when they realized that after all, giving women the chance to have access to resources meant that they were also helping the family itself. So the family benefited from women's agency more than if all the money went to men.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah. I think men realized and then supported the program.
When you looked at the causes, the factors that fed into poverty through generations, which factors are at the top of the list?
I think powerlessness was one.
Powerlessness.
Inability to think that they can get out of poverty by their own agency, because these things were stacked against them too much. There was collision between the moneylenders, the police, the elite. They were all against the poor, and they were paying the minimum wages to the poor, the landless people. And without some form of empowerment and building a sense of self-worth,
mm-hmm.
it was not possible to get the poor to understand that they could actually, by their own work, own activities, own action, can change their own lives and destinies. So what we had to do initially was to empower the poor, build a sense of self-worth in them, and then only that we could get poor to act on their own behalf to change their situation and defeat poverty.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what. So my work has been mostly on empowerment area in bringing about social change through empowerment and behavioral change among the poor themselves.
Where are efforts, the world's efforts in poor countries, poverty-stricken countries, has not been so effective? Do you think a problem has been, and it fits in with what you just said, that there has been a dependence that has been fostered rather than this...
Absolutely. I believe in that, because I think we have always looked at poor people as objects that we then need to be changed by us, and we never thought of poor people as subjects who can themselves be actors in history themselves, to act out of their own themselves to defeat poverty, to change their condition. And so I think the philosophy of development was, to some extent, had to change. The development practitioners felt that it is they who are changing poor people's lives. But we have always thought that it is us who are going to create the enabling conditions for the poor people to act on their own behalf and change their lives. Mm. So we ourselves, as a development practitioners, We felt that it's not our job to change poor people's lives. Our people was to create enabling conditions for them to be able to act on their own behalf. So when we started microfinance, financial services, it was an approach which was a market-based approach. We gave loans to poor people without collateral, and they repaid the loan. But then it was an opportunity, an enabling condition for them to have access to resources so that they could act, they could take advantage of that, invest it, use it in a particular way so that they could come out of poverty or increase their income.
I wonder if you can give me a concrete example. We talked about men. You focusing on women in Bangladeshi families because they bore the brunt of poverty. What happens generally, and this is generally speaking in Bangladeshi society, when you give a loan to a woman versus a man? How does a man spend it differently, typically?
So man looks at the woman as a part of the family. So if woman invests her money, let's say, buying a cow, and the family gets milk every day, so the family has a better nutrition. And if they sell milk to the neighbors and earn an income, a regular income from selling of milk from the cow, then of course the family has got a regular income to be able to so that they can feed the family throughout the year. So these are helpful. So enabling condition for the poor able to come out of poverty. So the men didn't resent that.
Yeah, but what would the men have done? Say you had employed this and given the loans to the men. What would have happened, do you think?
I think what would have happened is that he probably would have invested in somewhere else. He would probably also have used it for himself to some extent. He would be he'll be spending less of the resources for family's benefit, in other words, food and education for children and so on, which women do. And also I have found, for example, many defeated men, but very few defeated women.
You have, through your organization, provided opportunity for nearly 150 million people. What's left? You've had 40 years of leadership of the Bangladesh Rural Advancement Committee. Where do you want to take it from here?
Well, we have now gone into 11 other countries out of Bangladesh. And many of the things that we work in, our work in Bangladesh that has proven to be successful and effective. We have also taken some of them to other countries in Africa and Asia, and many of them with very minor adaptation has been used very effectively in other countries in Africa and Asia. So I think we have got something that we have learned we could share with our neighbors in the south who are also suffering from similar problems of poverty and deprivation.
Mm-hmm.
So that is happening. And we are expanding to other countries. We also find that, struggles, aspirations, dreams of the poor are remarkably similar in most countries, developing countries. So our programs to try and emancipate people out of poverty has been quite successful in other parts of Africa and Asia also, where we have been active in the last 10 years.
Mm-hmm. It's been over 40 years since you worked for Shell Oil there in accounting as a corporate executive. I'm just remembering your first words there when you said you can't look at what's happening in your homeland to continue as a comfortable corporate executive.
Right.
How often do you get in touch with the person you used to be and think about the huge decision you made at that moment?
Well, at that moment, at that time when I took the decision, most of my friends and family thought I was crazy. But then that crazy adventure was so satisfying and productive for me. So I have never looked back and thought that I have made a mistake. It has been extremely satisfying business of working to try and help people out of poverty in millions of people out of poverty in Bangladesh and now in Africa and Asia.
Mm-hmm. You're visiting Iowa as the 2015 World Food Prize laureate. You mentioned at the start that Iowa is roughly the size of Bangladesh. Can you see how we're different here from the people of your homeland?
Well, Iowa, of course, is the fruit of the bread basket of United States. You produced a lot of food for this country and also for the world. When Bangladesh started, we had a deficit of about 3 million tons of food grain that we needed to be imported for about to feed our people. Now, 42 years later, although our population has more than doubled, per capita food availability is much higher now, and we are food self-sufficient. So we don't need to import food from outside. So Iowa certainly, and particularly agricultural science, has contributed to better practices, better quality seeds, and so on, which has been part of the legacy of Norman Borlaug, who instituted the World Food Prize. So his legacy still has an impact in many countries in Africa and Asia.
Well, once again, congratulations on this well-deserved honor, the 2015 World Food Prize laureate, Sir Fasleh Hassan Abed. Thank you for this conversation, all that you've achieved with the Bangladesh Rural Advancement Committee, and thank you for sharing some of your thoughts with us on this edition of River to River.
Thank you very much, Mr. Kiefer. Thank you.
River to River is produced by Claire Roth, Lindsay Moon, and Emily Woodbury. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. If you'd like to find out more about our program, perhaps listen to a podcast, download a podcast, or listen to any of our previous programs, go to iowapublicradio.org. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.